would include minorities and lower-income people. I think you're probably all aware that those who vote tend to be older, better educated, and more well-off than people who do not vote currently. We're looking to broaden the electorate, and that's an important factor, especially as America is becoming more diverse, not certainly not less. The second unintended consequence is that mobile voters certainly may be left out of the process. In America, we are a very mobile society. That is especially true of younger people and of people with lower incomes, and certainly of renters. Again, on the California study, we found that vote-by-mail systems have a disparate impact on urban voters, which may be largely due to these mobility issues. Also, an all-vote-by-mail system may provide a greater opportunity for voter coercion, undue influence in casting a ballot, because it's done outside of the presence of election officials, and election fraud, particularly in the form of misappropriating a ballot. Election fraud, when it does occur, tends to be more in the areas of mail-in voting than in-person voting. And the bottom line, I think, which I've been discussing here, is that an all-vote-by-mail system restricts access to the polls to the 35 to 40% of voters who are not interested in putting their ballot in a mailbox. And that's a significant portion of your population. That brings us to the next topic, who gets a ballot. I've noticed in reading California statutes over the past several days that all registered, in all mail ballots, you do have provisions in place for your current all-mail vote ballot system, and it's optional. But all eligible registered electors are to get a ballot. On the other hand, the current law also says that inactive voters will not get a ballot in an all-mail election. I mean, it's, I believe, a very serious problem. That is, these people are eligible voters. They're on an inactive list for various reasons. I think in Colorado there are several categories of inactive voters. In many states there is just one, and that is those who are we're still working on this. Those who are on an active status because they have not responded to a confirmation letter sent in response to a national change of address notification to the election board. I believe if you do choose to go to an all-vote-by-mail ballot in any time in the future, this must be addressed first. We cannot simply leave out from the elections all those voters who, have, for one reason or another, have been placed on the inactive list, whether rightly or wrongly, by error, or because they are no longer at their address. We simply ignore them. I certainly understand the problems I have in sending out ballots to residents of the individual may no longer be there. It's a very thorny issue, and it must be addressed before you can go forward, I believe, with this particular election system. Let's see if we can get this going. And now we're to our friend, the United States Postal Service, which I believe Ms. O'Malley discussed earlier. It's rather difficult to get good data on the reliability of the United States Postal Service. And I have not had time to update it from my previous study on this issue, which was done in 2007. In 2007, first-class mail was delivered at the rate of 90% successful delivery. And there are, of course, many reasons why delivery may not take place, and they're not all because a person no longer lives there. I don't think that any of us would want to accept a 10% error rate in getting a ballot into a voter's hands. And it's a serious issue with the United States Postal Service. Even for overnight mail, which first class overnight mail, was 95%. And obviously people who are spending a lot of sending mail have probably taken care of the address. That's a very significant margin of error. And personally, I've never been able to put my precious ballot in a mailbox after having seen that. Urban, especially multi-residential buildings, have a very difficult time getting all of their mail, obviously. And the problem is exacerbated for them. Of course, their figures are included in the U.S. Postal Service reliability rates. And I must say, in reading the report in which those rates were reported, they were actually happy with them. That was their goal. That was their expectations. So that was a big error. So I really don't know what we're doing currently. Just to give you an example of problems faced by local election officials in Oregon at this point in time, there were 6% of Multnomah County, Oregon ballots were undeliverable in 2004. In Dayton County, over 7% were undeliverable, which is a significant number. When considered in conjunction with the inactive voter issue, this raises serious concerns. How do we address not giving ballots to voters who are eligible and want to vote, so that we have the right to choose whether to vote or not? And giving others to the wrong person. We don't want valid ballots being placed in the hands of the wrong person either. These are issues ahead of you all in this long discussion. And next, in the unintended consequences list, there are issues of mobility. Will all eligible voters, that's just even those on the active list, actually get their ballot? 1 in 8 voters nationally changed residences just in the 11 months in 2008 before the CPS study came out. And that's a significant number. We're an extremely mobile society. Minorities, young people, singles, and divorced people move at significantly above average rates. And this is also true for people with low incomes. 29% of those making over 25,000 change residences within a single year, whereas that compares to 12% of people in general, of people making over 100,000. Renters are 3 times more likely to change their residence in the course of a year. And that brings us all to the question, which must be debated and decided, is how will a voter who has changed residence get the mail-in ballot? What fail-safe provisions will you provide if you do move to an all-vote-by-mail system? Also point out at this point that the issue of mobility also disparately impacts minorities. And that is that 18% of black and 9% of multiracial citizens reported in November of 2008 that they were at their current address for less than 1 year. Okay. And going back again to this 2009 study, which I think is an excellent study because it controlled so many variables, was that across voter registered stratifications, being forced to vote by mail, this is a direct quote, has negative effects on the turnout of urban minority, Hispanic and Asian populations. For a mail ballot precinct in a fixed election, And fixed election characteristics, the estimated odds of voting decreases 50% for urban voters, 30% for Asian voters, and 27.3% for Hispanic voters. That's directly from a study which is called How Does Vote by Mail Affect Voters? It's by Elizabeth Bergen, Philip Yates, and Elaine Guild. Elaine Guild is a county elections director in Marin County. We also found in the 2009 study that having repeated vote-by-mail elections in a precinct did not seem to change voters' attitude, at least over this time period. They did not become, those who did not want to vote by mail did not become more interested in doing so or more acclimated to the system, which I think really points to the need to go very slowly in implementing anything such as this. This brings us next to the issue of election fraud. As a preliminary statement regarding election fraud, I would like to point out that it is very rare. In the national study, I believe there were 24 to 25 documented cases. I believe this was in 2007, for the 2006 election, which actually makes having voting fraud occur in your jurisdiction less likely than you being hit and killed, not just injured, by lightning. So we need to keep that in mind. So I don't think election fraud is the huge issue as consideration, but in all ballot elections, it is a somewhat more significant issue. And that is that when voter fraud is found, it's frequently in the area of absentee mail-in voting. We had just in the last election, that was reported in April last month in, I believe it was, Cameron County, Texas, at a election for county commissioner. There have been allegations of voter fraud all based on the mail-in ballots. And that is, one candidate had won both the early vote and the precinct vote, but of the between 250 and 300 vote-by-mail ballots, mysteriously, she got only 34. And all the rest went to her opponent, who then won by a few votes. And what they found, looking at it, was that the signatures weren't quite matching. And I understand that signature matching will be an important part of your work here. Whether in an optional vote-by-mail, which we certainly would prefer to see, or in all vote-by-mail. And in safeguarding against that, I'm sure you've all considered and thought of measures such as audits and signature matching. And that, combined with literally access to completed ballots, is very important. I believe you have on the books that a messenger, a person with someone else's ballot, can only have 10 in their possession, that more than that is illegal, which is a good thing to do. I also suggest limiting who may have that ballot. Right now, any person may be an agent and deliver. But in some states, they actually limit that to family members, friends, or people who are officially named as an agent to deliver. And so you're not giving it to a stranger. There's also more opportunity dealing with elderly or infirm voters that there may be undue influence in a mail election. Okay, now this brings us to our suggested best all vote-by-mail practices. And the first one would be notice, notice, notice. This, if implemented, would be a drastic, drastic change in what you have now. Although vote-by-mail has been very popular among the majority of your voters, a significant number still choose not to do that. And a very significant number still choose to vote early. I think the 2008 election, which remains to be seen if that was actually an outlier in some ways because of characteristics of that election, its historic nature. But we found that early voting was phenomenal nationwide. I believe 30% approximately voted early nationwide. And what we found, particularly from Project Vote's perspective, is that among African American voters voted at twice the rate of white voters they voted early. So I understand you have early voting in Colorado, and I would certainly urge you to retain that for the early voters who don't want to put their ballot in a ballot box, but who need or desire the convenience of voting more than during that 12-hour period on election day. So that would be very important. And that, another best practice, this was raised by Ms. O'Malley, which was to develop a very close partnership, even if you just continue your optional vote by mail system with the USPS. Working closely with them, as you've discussed, is critical because their fill rate is unacceptably high. And whatever you can do to limit that would be the best way to go, even with your optional. I recommend highly the work that you've done, Ms. O'Malley, in your direct contact with the United States Postal Service and in any contracts that you may enter into for this sort of work. Working closely, keeping on top of them would be very important. I've already mentioned in Ontario we're increasing early voting centers. I believe that may be somewhat controversial in light of a desire to limit the number of actual polling places. But as we said, there is still a significant number of our population who want a polling place to feel secure that their ballot is getting in the hands of a trusted election official and not into a third party's hands. Another issue that goes to the mobility issue that we discussed earlier is to implement registration portability. Florida, for example, has a simple and very straightforward law in the books that deals with the problem of voters who have moved either just before the election or perhaps within the last year and not updated their records. In Florida, if the law is that if you moved anywhere within the state, you go to the new precinct in the jurisdiction which you currently live, sign an affidavit, give proof of your new residence, and vote a regular ballot. And I would certainly recommend that as a way to, in many respects, overcome if more vote by mail is anticipated, to overcome the problems, significant problems that exist with mobility. And that brings me to my last slide, which, voila, I skipped right past. And that is to make your vote-by-mail ballots visually distinguishable, particularly for so many purposes. The reason being that you don't want them lost in the mail, that someone will get their ballot and think it's just a promotional material and toss it. That probably isn't a significant problem, but it can occur. And for other reasons, for purposes of counting. Create effective fail-safe measures for those voters who, for whatever reason, fail to receive a ballot so that they may cast, hopefully, a regular ballot or a fallback position of being a provisional ballot that will be counted, assuming that they are who they say they are and they live where they say they live. We also would suggest mailing ballots to inactive voters, particularly with a broader definition of inactive voters, which I believe you have here. And the last point, which has been an overall point, and that is to approach all vote-by-mail systems with a great deal of caution and thought in preparation for the significant problems that it will raise. There are certainly problems that exist now that all vote-by-mail may address, chief among them being cost. But there are many other problems that it may raise, and it behooves all of us to give those some thoughts. So I would recommend a gradual process in considering all vote-by-mail. Thank you for the time today, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to discuss.
Carol Murray, thank you. I guess I didn't really see the connection between mobility and problems with mail ballots. It seems to me mobility is an issue for voting behavior in general. So that if you take care of being able to re-register someone, as you says Florida does, and we've talked about that, and we have that in place in Colorado too, and certainly that's something that's easy to mitigate. I don't see that mobility is necessarily related to issues with mail ballots only. It's with voting behavior in general.
Well, I think it affects elections in two ways. One is getting your registration system updated, which is, you know, your general system, but it also affects a voter in an election. If they have failed to update their registration right now, they very well lose their franchise. And registration portability does eliminate that. And as relates to all vote by mail, obviously if the ballot does not get in a person's hands in time, then they must find the alternative method to getting the ballot and casting that ballot, which may discourage voters, particularly those who already may feel somewhat marginal to the system, you know, and there are significant numbers of those people. So the mobility is an issue, and it does impact disparately lower income people, people of color, ethnic minorities, recent immigrants who've been naturalized, in those groups. So mobility, I think, has been demonstrated in Oregon, for instance, those statistics I just mentioned, in which their county officials found that 6 to 7% of mail ballots were not successfully delivered. And that's a substantial number, in absolute numbers, a substantial number of votes lost.
Did they have any information about the failure to vote rate versus undeliverable?
With the failure to vote, meaning you haven't received your ballot?
Like unsuccessfully being able to cast a ballot.
I did not.
An effort to cast a ballot.
I did not look for statistics like that. I'm sure they're out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I participated in a research project for that same Pew early voting with one of the recipients of grant for that. And it was very similar to a room like this, the discussion on those papers. Mm-hmm. And so I've read those studies. And I think one of the really important things is to place them into appropriate context. That being said, the existing rules and laws and standards and processes that we have, I think one of the mobility issue is one of the most interesting ones, but I tend to agree that I think that's why we keep linking the registration and ballot delivery method at the same time, because mobility is more of a voting behavior issue. And I do think that there, what is important is to make sure that we ensure that there aren't additional barriers for our citizens. And that's what we need to keep in mind with safeguards and the Postal Service and such barriers, yeah, and updating registration. I think that is one of the topics we'll be talking about down the road is the use of technology and be able to do that. How do you capture those mobile populations? One of the topics that was discussed at the early voting meeting that I participated in as well was sort of what we touched on in the last meeting was the culture of early voting and the evolution of early voting in your particular jurisdiction. For example, you've seen a big increase in early voting. It is a really big question about whether or not the 2008 is an isolated data set with respect to early voting. What I'm interested in for Colorado is what we did not see a spike. We've seen more of an evolution towards that. And one of the papers that you quoted, I believe was a jurisdiction either Orange County or LA County, I can't remember. And they have, in LA County, 4 million voters and one early voting site. And I think that's significant when you're talking about voting behavior and what the options you provide and how people behave with respect to the, you know, how they interact with a ballot. If they're unaccustomed to receiving a paper ballot, my mail, that ballot delivery system, how educated over time are they about their options for receiving the enfranchisement? And I am more interested in data that actually talks about the inability, the failure to vote in an attempt. I think that's also an important data set versus undeliverable. I think the undeliverable is interesting to us because of cost, because of whether or not how accurate and how available U.S. Postal Service, how responsive they are to us. But I also think that for example, it'll be interesting to see how the service center concept, whether used in a primary or in a general election, if it's used there as well, how successful people are in being able to find those locations, and whether or not they were unsuccessful because they did not have that voter education and outreach. They didn't have availability to that information.
Thank you.
It does seem like the recording is compromised enough. I'm getting text messages from friends saying, oh, it's something with your microphone, Teresa, apparently, is what I'm hearing. But
not working.
In any event, I was going to ask if we couldn't get a copy of this to post on the website, because we may not have a recording that can go back to later.
Okay.
And my question, I have a couple, about how we can gather better data come this next general election. And if for instance, SCORE is capable of determining out of the permanent mail-in ballot status individuals, what percentage of them are property owners or single owner occupied homes? I'd be interested in learning that. If 64% voted via mail on last election, which percentage were property owners? Which are stable addresses? As Teresa, you've cited before, the difference between a non-stable address and a stable address. I think a couple of years ago when we set up the permanent absentee ballot status, it did target stable addresses. And non-stable addresses then have a greater challenge, I know, for clerks and for those voters to get ballots. I even had questions whether, you know, these numbers regarding the difficulties in lower income and minority voters getting their ballots, if there are any equal protection violations with this, and if that's ever been explored.
Well, I believe that would be a litigation issue, and let's hope that we never face that. That has been explored in various contexts, the equal protection argument in election-related litigation. And there is a concern about, you know, voting sort of statewide, and I think many states face this, seeing somewhat different practices from a county for county on a county-to-county basis is a problem that also has been addressed in equal protection. I believe it's now a 5-year-old case in Ohio that seems to be coming to a close on just that issue, the uniformity statewide under an equal protection argument. And if you excuse me, I will sit down for the rest of my presentation. Your altitude is getting to me.
Carol Murray, I had one more comment about the power of early voting in this last election. When I was an elected official, it was really hard to get the word out about what was going on with elections unless it was like 2 days before the election. And so people didn't know about early voting. The really neat thing about the 2008 election was presidential candidates nationwide were talking about early voting. And that was a first from my viewpoint. And many states probably did not have early voting previously. We need to remember in Colorado that all of the options that we offer voters are very unique. Nationwide. I mean, as I see, 30 states have no-fault absentee. You talk to people in some states, and they can't believe that you can just ask for an absentee ballot without proving that you weren't in the hospital or something. So I think the communication piece that she addressed is so important of trying to get the word out to people, and that's a challenge that we all have. But I think that's why we had such a good early voting turnout in 2008.
Yeah, just to add to that, we we in Colorado do things in every single possible way that they can be done. We have every vendor. We have every way you can possibly vote. We do it early. We do it late. We do it in every way you can do it. So, I mean, that in some ways, you know, it's wonderful for our voters. In other ways, I think it adds costs and burdens, and it makes our job at state sometimes very difficult. One thing I was going to speak to, one of the things that Joe just asked about the study, I'm not, off the top of my head, I can't think of how we would know that out of score, whether or not someone was a property owner or not. I mean, maybe we would on a special district level, but I'm not sure. Our data set doesn't connect to that, so I'm not sure that we would know that. So,
could it produce data on turnout each day of early voting in the lead up to an election, and make out all those numbers for election day and precinct, early vote? Those numbers,
sure.
That's it readily available already on the website?
It's not on the website, I don't believe, but it's something we could easily come up with. We keep track of every time a ballot is entered, you know, runs through us, is pinged by a locality. That goes into our score system, so we know when a ballot comes in. So if somebody votes early, we know it. If they come in as a mail ballot, we know it. So we can produce that data, although I'm not totally sure what that'll tell us, but it's certainly reproducible.
Yeah, I'm curious. Joe, it just gets back to the cost question. If it would be useful to the clerks and the Secretary of State to know kind of the flow of which part of the electoral continuum timeline is more expensive, where you're going to run into costs, when you might see a spike in cost if problems occur.
Well, one of the things we haven't talked about in this group, but will eventually, I think, be part of the conversation, is to what degree do you need to also expand your enfranchisement options as related to mail ballots? So if you're going to do mail ballot, right now we have a 29-day window to register to vote. And do you need to play with that at all? I mean, do you need to compensate for the fact that because you're mailing out ballots, people may be unaware of the fact that that deadline is already passed and you can't get that mail ballot anymore, or that at the time in which all their friends are getting mail ballots, they're going, well, where's mine? Oh, I've moved and I didn't tell anybody. Well, there's got to be a way to overcome that, or, you know, that's certainly something for people or policymakers to consider. So,
Joe, I think the stable address question is an interesting one, but I'm not sure how it's different related to mail ballot except for delivery of a ballot. And you're right, the costs for that. And I think the value in the state of Colorado has always fallen on the benefit of the voter. Instead of playing with the addresses, you know, we send it to where we think you were, right? I think the question about stable addresses, though, as a pertains to polling places, how do you get access to the ballot, whether or not the ballot was delivered to you, but how do you vote the enfranchisement and where? And if you have, you know, and the concern is that with the more mobile community, is that ballot delivery method is more unsuccessful in a more mobile community because they're not updating that information, which lends to a more registration-based question, more than mail ballot versus polling place, because essentially in our administration world, mail ballot is a ballot delivery system. We have more ballots dropped off than mailed. We have more ballots, you know, with the service center, and it behaves differently in different jurisdictions. In special district mail ballot districts in California, it will behave differently because of your electoral culture, the amount of voter information and outreach. I would also tell you that in less mobile, in more mobile communities, those postcards aren't getting to them either, right? And so how do we address that issue? And I think it's more of registration requires a residency of some declaration. And how do you address that in those communities versus a mail ballot versus polling place argument?
I think my point on that was that in an all-mail ballot election, that has certainly exacerbated the problem of mobility. much less so than in a precinct-based or in an early voting, early and post in-person voting option. So the problem is simply worse. It's multiplied because every voter will essentially be receiving their ballot by mail.
I'm actually glad you brought that up, because the question that I posed was that that's about geography, right, and distance from a polling place, you would assume. I mean, that's sort of what we're saying, is that if the ballot doesn't get to them, do they just say, well, okay, I'm done, versus a precinct, maybe a neighborhood polling place versus distance. So it would be interesting to look at whether or not people have barriers to successfully, you know, using their franchise with vote centers versus precinct polling places. My county has precinct polling places. And so the argument would be that there would be a drop-off in vote centers as well, because if it's more mobile, they say, oh, I didn't get a ballot, or where's my polling place? It's a barrier of geography or transportation. I guess that when you were talking about that, I was trying to apply it to what we do here in Colorado.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. But the issue is getting the ballot in the hand of the voter, and I think it's less about geography and the distance to the precinct place, although those are really important considerations, than just simply getting that ballot in their hand. A voter must be significantly motivated to go out and seek that ballot. And if they just can't get up and go down to a voting center, let's hope there are several, then how will they get that ballot? And that will affect the voter motivation and other voting behaviors. I mean, obviously, the system and voter behavior interact.
So we're assuming there's no other mechanism for them to get the ballot except through the mail.
I'm not saying that, but it takes a motivated, that voter will have to have the knowledge and the motivation, if they haven't received their ballot, to find out how to get it. And here I'm not familiar with the Colorado system, and perhaps you can educate me on that, and what you do when a voter shows up and said, I didn't get my ballot. Who do they contact?
Right.
Where do they contact?
Well, I'm comparing that to a polling place environment, though.
No different.
I mean, if a voter is not, doesn't receive a voter information card, for example, or they don't see any voter education and route outreach, how is that different from not receiving a ballot in the mail? I guess, so the question, do you understand what I'm saying? I think we're talking similarly. It's just about what our laws are here. And I think it's an interesting question for accessibility, actually, Faye. So I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit about that, because Is there a true barrier for someone who has difficulty going a further distance to a polling place? And what, I mean, that's a physical barrier. I don't know if it's real versus imagined, but a physical barrier to their enfranchisement that, you know, we have lots of options here in Colorado when we're looking at reducing potential options. What are those actual barriers? And I'm just not quite seeing the ballot delivery method as the barrier versus the polling place. In this example?
Well, I think the ballot delivery component is very important, and of course it becomes more important in an all vote by mail system. It's important because if the ballot doesn't get to that person with a reasonable degree of convenience, because we've seen how voters love their convenience with early voting and mail-in balloting, and that voter then has to go the extra mile, figuratively speaking, to get a ballot in their hands, that can affect participation in that election. And I think that is a significant, from my perspective, a significant factor.
Thank you.
I know last election there was a call center that Project Election Protection Colorado Common Cause. Just Vote Colorado, I should know. But there are some, I don't know, 1,700 calls that came in over the period of early voting and election day, and a lot of them were that very thing. Oh, I didn't get my mail ballot, what do I do? It's a pretty common occurrence. My question about a figure, you said the likelihood of voting would go down, or in California went down 13.2%. Was it unless or in spite of four pieces of promotional mail going to the voter?
I believe the study found that it took at least four to make a difference in that sort of response. on an individual level, the decision to vote went down 13.9%.
And so that gets back to our cost projections for what an all-mail in-ballot election might cost to run effectively if we would have to, you know, send a minimum of 4 pieces of mail to the mobile voter or unstable addresses and to offset those that disenfranchisement that could happen.
Taking
no, you go right ahead.
I believe the one study on the 4 pieces of mail was actually asking the question, how much voter information would move turnout? So at what point does voter information mailings move turnout, which is was a really interesting question to ask considering what we've seen over the last several years in Colorado about outreach and postcards and forwarding and non-forwarding and all of that. And they found a very slight movement of turnout. I think it was in the 1-point-something% range after 4 postcards. So that was one study. You may be referring to a different one, and it was really talking about, I mean, it was an interesting conversation because it turned into this discussion about that holy grail of turnout versus the opportunity, equal opportunity available, and the transaction cost of trying to get a little movement in turnout, which is interest to a lot of people, all of us, and that cost and the balance between it. So it is really good studies, really good information. But I think that's what the postcard mailing was referring to.
I believe that this was internal to this study, and their focus was not on the notice issue. They did find in those, I believe, in those counties in which there was better notice that they had, or those precincts that enjoyed better notice, they had a better response, right?
This is Stephanie O'Malley. In response to, you know, the notion of, you know, what will assist the voter in terms of educating them about any particular environment, I think this group also needs to be mindful of what is too much saturation that will ultimately tip the voter to the point of deciding that they've had enough and they're not going to vote because they're just to the point of sick and tired, if you would, of receiving mailings not only from the local county level but also we have to recognize that they're getting mailings from campaigns, candidates, telephone calls. I know in our last special election we just had on May 4th in Denver, we got some complaints like that ultimately voters decided to not cast their mail ballot simply because there was too much communication going to them, not from, you know, the elections division, but the whole entire, you know, picture, if you would, together, the global picture. It's the ED, it's everybody that is encouraging that voter to vote. So there's a real delicate balance. And we have to be mindful that in our attempts as county clerks or whomever the state to educate with regards to a particular elections model, is that is something that is separate and distinct from all the other mailings that we're legally required to provide to the voter, you know. So that whole kind of election cycle, voters are getting tons and tons of things in the mail, and ultimately they're going to say, oh, geez, here's just another one, you know, and that ballot could be the one that they dismiss that they should be paying, you know, a lot of attention to. So I just want us to be cognizant of how we approach that education piece, and the communication can slant both ways.
I think the issue of communicating with the voters is less of an issue as I think Pam was saying earlier, it's a question of the opportunity to exercise their franchise. And I think as we have this discussion and we continue forward, I mean, I think we just need to be cognizant of that. You know, what are all of the safeguards and the pieces that need to be a part of whatever system ultimately that goes forward to make sure that anyone who chooses to exercise that right, they're minimal or I would say no barriers, but I mean that's impossible unless we're all going to, you know, of course going to hire someone to show up at everyone's door to hand them a ballot, you know, so.
Any other comments or questions for Teresa? Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming all this way.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I think Faith Gross was our next person to give testimony. Faith, tell us who you are and tell us what you think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Faith Gross. Most of you know me. I'm with the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People, and I just added up the years, and it's been a little over 7 years that I've been doing our voting accessibility, voting rights program for people with disabilities statewide. And for those of you who are not familiar with that program, we are authorized under the Help America Vote Act and also federally funded under HABA. I will be pretty brief. It's been a long afternoon, and I'm sure most of you are tired. And I will I did not prepare a formal presentation. I got the invitation yesterday morning to come and present to you, so I really didn't allow a lot of time, but it is a topic that I'm comfortable talking, discussing. First of all, most important point is that voters with disabilities are generally reflective of the general population. And the people first and have a disability is just one characteristic. Mail voting by mail in Colorado is very popular in the disability community and also even more so among elders, and particularly elders who have disabilities. However, that said, many folks with disabilities and elders still prefer to have a choice of methods of how they're going to vote. And what I found over the past 2 years in particular is that the length of our ballot and the long lines, particularly during the 2006 election in several counties, have driven many people to choose to vote by mail. I think we all heard stories of people. The one story that I remembered, I'm sorry, Stephanie, but a woman who was using oxygen in Denver whose oxygen tank ran out before she got to vote during the 2006 vote center debacle. So anybody in the disability community who's an activist has heard that story, and people are concerned about the long lines. Voting on a ballot last year during the 2008 election, I did vote early in the general election on DRE in Denver. I went in extremely well prepared, knew exactly how I was voting, and it took me 9 minutes to vote. Now, I do not use the audio access features of the accessible voting systems. I know of a voter in Jefferson County who is blind who also went to her polling place to vote on the machine using the audio access, and she was very well prepared, and it took her 45 minutes to vote on the Ivotronic with that audio access because it reads every single word on the ballot. So if you think about how long the ballots were, yes, and that particular system does not allow you, I believe, to speed up the speed. Some of the accessible voting systems do allow for that increase in speed. So the usability of the accessible voting systems for some folks is a factor. It takes too long. It's too stressful. Some people are not familiar with that technology, so they have to learn the technology, and so they just choose to vote by mail. That said, I have been out doing early voting, primaries, on election day, visiting polling places, doing accessibility audits, and in every single county that I have been to, I have personally observed people with visible disabilities going into the polls, whether it be a precinct polling place or a vote center, but going in to vote. People using walkers, people with oxygen, people, rarely people who are blind, but people in wheelchairs, people who have some obvious disability. So people with disabilities still choose to vote in their polling places or vote centers. I, when I'm out in the community, I'm advocating that people with visible disabilities or observable disabilities be seen voting. And many other disability advocates do the same thing, and it's because we want politicians to know that we vote, so that they will take us seriously and pay attention to our issues. Politicians, candidates know that seniors vote, and they take seniors very seriously and pay attention to their issues. So that's one of the messages that we're putting out in the disability community, is that we want you to be visible in voting so that folks will know that you're interested and that this is important to you and that they need to listen to you. So let's talk about if we did do an all-male election and what some of the barriers are. Of course, because HAVA, Help America Vote Act, and its requirement that every polling place have an accessible voting system is not going to go away if we decide to go to all-male elections. We will still have to have at least, at a minimum, one accessible voting location in each county and each jurisdiction for every election, at least every federal election. However, transportation to that location may be very difficult, particularly for the very same people who may choose to go to vote on an accessible voting system. So somebody who is blind or somebody visually impaired or who maybe has a mobility disability, maybe the same person who is not independent in driving and would have to rely on either public transportation or somebody else to provide transportation to get to that accessible voting location. But in a county such as Denver, in the metro area, where we have good public transportation that is accessible, that's not a huge barrier, although it is somewhat of a barrier. But in our rural counties, many which have no accessible transportation, it could be a significant barrier. Some people who would need assistance in voting may not have a trusted person in their life who could assist them with voting. I have heard, unfortunately, many stories, particularly in a blind community, of folks who do not trust their spouse. Oftentimes when I hear the story, it's my ex-spouse. I could never trust my husband, I could never trust my wife to actually mark my ballot the way I instructed them to mark it, and there was no way of knowing how my ballot was actually marked. Maybe it's not a family member, but somebody who is fairly isolated and doesn't have somebody to provide that assistance. Group residential facilities, there has been concern expressed about people being taken advantage of or fraudulently or voting somebody else's ballot in a group residential facility. And I want to stop right here for a minute. Yesterday, the Accessibility Task Force for the Secretary of State did meet, and I posed the question to the other members of our task force, which is pretty good cross-disability representation, and asked folks, you know, what's your input on all-male elections? And this issue did come up, the concern about people who are in group residential facilities being taken advantage of or losing their private vote or somebody else voting their ballot without their direction. So last year, during the 2009 legislative session, we changed the trigger for the county clerk to send out a committee to deliver and pick up mail ballots for group residential facilities. The trigger used to be, I believe it was more than 5, and now it's more than 7. One of my coworkers is the state ombudsman for long-term care facilities, and I remember last year asking her how many just assisted living facilities are there in the state that have fewer than 7 residents. And I don't have the exact number, but it was in the 250 range. So those are just assisted living facilities, which are by definition group residential facilities, where even if every single resident requested a mail-in ballot, that trigger would not be reached, and so there would be nobody there to protect their rights. Group residential facilities for people with intellectual disabilities or developmental disabilities are typically smaller than 7 people. So again, if you had every single resident of a group home requesting a mail-in ballot, that trigger would not be reached. Let's see. The other thing that I hear a lot in the disability community is what I call an urban myth, which is that, and people are still calling them absentee ballots, not mail-in ballots, that absentee ballots are only counted after the fact if it's a close election. And even though all of us in this room know that that is not true, there are many, many people out there, many, many voters who believe absolutely that that is true. That only in a close election will my absentee or my mail-in ballot get counted. But if it's not a close election, then they're not going to count my ballot. And I hear it every single year. So part of my education and outreach work is to dispel that myth. But it is very widely believed. So what are some recommendations or some solutions to address some of these barriers? And so I went to Oregon. And I unfortunately did not have time to talk to my counterpart in Oregon, but I did visit the Secretary of State's website, and she and I in previous years have had discussions about all mail ballots. And one of the things that they're doing in Oregon that's very exciting and is actually fairly recent is what they call alternate format ballots. And this is where we're going to get into email and computer technology and internet technology. A voter can request an alternate format ballot, and that ballot can be either a large print ballot or it could be, I suppose it could be a braille ballot, although they don't specify that in the materials that I've received from Oregon, or it could be an emailed ballot or a ballot mailed in U.S. mail on a computer disk. That voter then, and this is for voters who may have adaptive or assistive technology on their home computers. So, for example, a voter who is blind may have JAWS, J-A-W-S, all caps, which is a software that is a screen reader. And so allows somebody who is blind or has low vision or somebody with a reading disability to access what's on the computer screen. So for individuals who have computer access in their homes, they can get an electronic ballot, electronic format, load that ballot onto their home computer, mark the ballot on their home computer, and then in Oregon what they do is they print it out and then return that printed ballot just like any other voter would. However, because that printed ballot is going to look different than all the other ballots, then that ballot has to be duplicated to be processed or tallied or counted by the optical scan system. So that's where the voter then loses their private ballot, particularly if they're the only voter in their jurisdiction who's voting that way. I would think that if you had several voters who are voting on these mail or on these electronic ballots, then you could batch those, I suppose, and do them all at once. But then you know how that group voted, but the individual maintains some privacy. They're also doing, each county clerk's office in Oregon has a fully loaded accessible computer station with a printer in their offices, and so voters can go there and vote on that system. However, the same transportation problems exist in Oregon as they do in Colorado. But they also have, in addition to that one station in each county, county clerk's office, they have a laptop with a printer that they can take into the community. And as I understand it, they will even go to an individual's home upon request with that laptop so that that individual can vote from home and have a somewhat private and independent ballot. They also have these laptops that they can take them to libraries, to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, group homes, any places where people with disabilities are likely to congregate. I do have to point out, though, that Oregon didn't spend any of their HAVA funds on voting machines. They did not spend the millions and millions of dollars like all the other states did on purchasing HAVA-compliant accessible voting systems. So they had that money to buy these laptops to implement all these things. An individual chooses to vote on the same mail ballot as everybody else, but they want to vote from home and they need assistance. Oregon will send election judges to the individual's house to provide that assistance. Signatures. We talked a little bit here today about verifying signatures, and this has been a concern of mine from the beginning of doing this program back in 2004. Many people's signatures change as a result of a disability. Many people's signatures change as we age. Our signatures may change. And so the whole signature verification process, even though people assure me that we train our election judges to do this, I'm not convinced that that's enough of a safeguard. In Oregon now, they're allowing people to use signature stamps. And I believe that we do allow people in Colorado to use signature stamps. This is particularly popular in the blind community and also for people, say, with quadriplegia, who do not have use of their hands. So in Oregon, very specifically, the use of a signature stamp is okay. That is fine on mail ballots. I think those are all my notes. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them for you.
About the group living or group quarters, as they're called, I know that Census Bureau has a great challenge in getting census forms to people living in nursing homes, assisted livings, and dormitories, fraternities, sororities. I wonder if, given that some of those facilities are for the disabled or elderly, what challenges those group living quarters present in getting ballots to people there.
So that's a question for the clerks.
Oh, you want to hear from another clerk besides?
This is Stephanie O'Malley in Denver. We haven't had any significant challenges in getting ballots to residential group facilities. We identify them and do outreach to their coordinators, the facility coordinators, and inquire as to whether or not, they want our presence in their facility. And again, I will reiterate, we make that overture, and there are some who take advantage of our teams coming out and abiding by the law and assisting in delivering the ballots, their mail ballots. But there are also concerns, as I expressed a few moments ago, with regards to just the sheer, at least from the perspective of the facility, the continued badgering, if you would, because that's a term that some of them used, relative to how much overture they're getting, not only from the clerks, but from the candidates and the parties and that kind of thing. And that's the piece that has seemingly become a little bit troublesome. But as far as ballots and getting that to them, we do a really good job at that.
And I would like to actually add that in Denver in particular, we'll refer. I do a lot of voter registration and outreach work, and a lot of times those referrals come from Denver Elections here in Denver, where Denver Elections might get a call from a group facility asking for somebody to come out and do voter registration, and then they'll refer that call to me, and I will go out and do voter registration. So I've done quite a bit over the years at group residential facilities. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Beth. The last person that we wanted to have speak today, and she doesn't have a lot of time, so I'll ask her to truncate her comments, would be Hillary Rudy, who's a member of the staff here at the Division of Elections. She is the head of our legal department, and she is going to talk to us about the elements of a proposed bill that sort of made it through the discussion portion of pre-legislation this last year, but didn't actually make it into the legislative arena. And so these are sort of the topics of things that were discussed, things that were on the table, which I think might serve as a good framework for our discussion going forward about what this group would find acceptable in terms of mail ballot. So, Hillary.
Hi, good afternoon. Hillary Rudy with the Elections Division. So there's been a lot of discussion over the past several months about mail ballot legislation and what that would look like. So I just wanted to mention a couple of the key pieces of those discussions and kind of the key discussions that I think need to happen in terms of addressing legislatively all of the moving parts of mail ballot elections. So in looking at the discussions about mail ballot elections for state and federal elections, the first kind of issue that comes up is who gets the ballot, whether the ballots are mailed only to active electors or whether ballots need to be mailed also to electors who are inactive for failure to vote. In 2009, ballots were mailed to inactive failed to vote electors for the odd year or coordinated elections, and in primary elections that are conducted by mail ballot, all affiliated inactive failed to vote electors will be getting the ballot automatically mailed to them. But that's always, I think, a key topic of discussion is whether or not ballots go out to only active or whether we expand that to inactive failed to vote, and, of course, how we communicate that to the electors. Mail ballot timelines also, when the ballots get mailed, is a key factor. For example, right now the law says that ballots go out 22 days prior to the election, and that becomes a pretty big question mark when you start looking at a November general election in terms of whether or not that's a sufficient amount of time. 22 days prior to a November election will always fall on Columbus Day, which does shorten that mailing timeline by at least a day. So certainly careful discussion should be had about whether or not 21 days is sufficient in, say, a presidential election to ensure that all electors will receive their ballots and have sufficient opportunity to return them. Along with the provisions for state and federal election mail ballots, it's important also to consider the impact on local jurisdiction elections. Currently, the mail ballot law also deals with special districts and municipalities, and they run by, in many cases, a very different set of timelines and procedures for their local elections. And so it's important in adopting provisions for state and federal elections that we make sure we leave provisions in place for special districts and municipalities that choose to conduct their elections by mail ballot, that don't subject them to unnecessary requirements or inapplicable requirements dealing with partisan elections. Also, it's important to consider the options. I think earlier it was mentioned that we do currently provide an option that kind of meets the need of every elector. And so in considering a transition to mail ballots, it's important to consider whether there are sufficient options available for electors who simply do not choose to vote by mail. There are some electors who do not prefer to vote by mail. And so there was discussion over the past year about whether there should be some sort of an opt-out procedure whereby an elector could say, I do not wish to vote by mail. And does that look like the elector gets their ballot in the mail and then may choose to return it in the method they prefer? Or does that mean that an elector who opts out would not get a ballot in the mail and they would be expected to appear in person at a service center location or the clerk's office? So that was a pretty significant area of discussion, and I think there are both policy and cost implications there, because certainly you don't want to be mailing ballots to electors who are going to come in and hand that ballot to you and expect to vote in some other method. And you also want to make sure we're offering the elector the option that they want to vote on. need to consider unique voter groups. We want to make sure that as we adopt changes to the election code that we're not adopting any changes that adversely affect unique elector groups, such as military and overseas citizens. Federal law has recently changed, allowing for additional time for mailing those ballots, so we always want to be careful of ensuring that there is sufficient time in the election code for mailing those ballots and we don't come into conflict with federal law. Also, considering whether we need to make any changes to the election code to deal with group residential facilities or those types of unique elector groups. Currently, the provisions for delivering and returning ballots to group residential facilities apply when there are more than seven mail-in ballot requests. So it's in a polling place election when those electors choose to vote by mail. And so we need to, I think, have careful consideration of whether that would extend to a situation where we would mail all ballots out in the election. So we want to make sure that we put sufficient provisions in place to protect that unique voter group. Another significant area of discussion is how the ballots are returned, how voters can vote if they choose not to vote the mail ballot, so service centers and drop-off locations. The discussion over the past several months is sort of centered around the formula that's in place for mail ballots in a primary election, and that's based upon either the number of Department of Motor Vehicle offices with a minimum for a population threshold, which is a little different than they do it in states like Oregon or Washington, where they do it strictly based upon a population threshold or just a minimum. So, for example, in mail ballot primaries, the number of service centers, which would be full service locations where you could update your address, do an emergency registration, vote on the accessible equipment, obtain a replacement ballot. There would be provisional voting, so it would be full service voting or registration options. For the primary election, the formula requires that there's one per motor vehicle office, but no fewer than one location for 60,000 active affiliated electors. Now, there's a different threshold if you have a significantly high number of motor vehicle offices in relation to the population, and there's also a different threshold for counties with fewer than 30,000 active affiliated electors. So that's where the conversation in Colorado has centered, is the number of locations that have the technology base to offer those services, but also taking into account population requirements. And then there's also a discussion about whether those need to be geographically and, I guess, physically located so that they're more accessible to the population. In states like Oregon and Washington, it's purely population-based. Oregon, for example, in counties with more than 35,000 electors, they need to have at least one walk-in voting location for every 20,000. As you heard earlier, Oregon does things a little bit differently than Colorado in that they don't use necessarily the accessible voting equipment, but they provide the accessible voting options at those locations. In terms of drop-off locations, pretty uniformly they just require two per county. Washington, on the other hand, requires at least one walk-in voting location in every county, but the number is ultimately determined by the county itself. So there's a lot of variety even amongst the two states that have mail ballot voting for all elections. So it may be better in Colorado to go back and look at lessons learned from the primary elections, as well as what we already know about how our coordinated elections operate. But certainly the number of locations for walk-in voting and for ballot delivery will be a pretty, I think, serious point of conversation. Certainly we need to make sure we have enough so that if there are significant numbers of folks who want to vote in person in a particular jurisdiction, that we don't create lines. But we also want to make sure that there aren't so many that it becomes a waste of judges and staffing and money, because certainly there are cost savings to be had in conducting mail ballot elections, as Russ pointed out earlier. And then finally, I think the other area of discussion that really needs to be considered is the notice to the electors. There's a pretty complicated scheme of notice mailings already in Colorado for the various election activities, and so it should be discussed whether or not those notices that are currently in place are sufficient, whether they should be either in content or in deadlines changed in any way. So, for example, prior to a general election, the postcard notice goes out no later than 45 days prior to the election. Well, if you're mailing the ballot at least 21 days prior to the election, is 45 days enough notice to let the voter know that a ballot's coming, update your information if you need to, because the closer you get that postcard notice to the actual mailing of the ballot, the more probability is with mobile society that you're going to get the cards back with changes as you already have those ballots dropping in the mail, which results in a delay in voters getting the ballots at their actual address. So it's always a little bit of a balancing act between providing notice too far in advance but providing it sufficiently in advance so that the voter can update their information if they need to, get their ballot, and make sure that we aren't sending ballots out to addresses where the voters no longer reside. So there are a lot of, I think, moving parts in terms of what that legislation would look like, but it's important to make sure that we thoughtfully look at every piece of the legislation, because certainly it's not helpful, I think, to either the voters or the counties when we inadvertently create, problems with deadlines or those sorts of things. So those are the key pieces of discussions that we've had so far. I'm sure there are other pieces that will become important as we move on, but...
Questions for Hillary? Actually, I have a question for the group related to Hillary, so I'll make Hillary stand up there. It seems like we could go a couple of different directions here. We could staff this up, we could draft up something, and then we could discuss it, and we could sort of measure the will of the group. Or this could serve as a great framework for a 2 or 3 hour discussion next time to go over each one of these and hammer out what the group's particular inclination is on a given point. Do you have a preference along those lines? Number two? Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense to me. So why don't we do this the next meeting? Maybe we'll ask Hillary back, and she could do the quick 5-minute version of that, and then we'll go into each one of those items, and we'll discuss them at length. And we might even find that at that point it might be helpful to have particular witnesses speak on particular issues. In fact, there might be those among us who would like to speak on particular issues. So if they were to tell me and I can get them on the schedule, that would make sense. Yes, ma'am.
Catherine Young. Judd, would it be possible for us to get a copy of what the past legislation looked like, so it would give us an idea of what our discussion might center around at the next meeting?
You
don't want to read it.
So how about this? How about it's not a matter of it probably is a matter of the fact that it's a failed piece of legislation. It never made it. And so it may not be a good starting point. But Hillary's notes we could very much draft up, and then that would be, I think, a good bullet point, starting point. The other thing that is different about that particular piece of legislation is so much of that legislation dealt with issues unrelated to mail ballot. So there's a whole bunch of other parts to it. So we could start kicking out the legs and the table could just sort of crash, and so it doesn't really make much sense to, I think, start at that starting point. That's my 2 cents. I see no head nodding the wrong way. So. Yes, sir?
Just perhaps an observation. This is Ryan Call for those listening for the record. If we're going to address some of these, are there other topics that may be related that aren't part of Hillary's list? And I'm thinking that it seems like a gaping hole would be, ballot security or those kinds of issues, challenge procedures, the role of different kind of players in the conduct of elections. If we're focusing specifically on mail ballot, I think those are other elements that need to be part of that discussion.
Excellent. Yeah, that's great. Are there other things? Because we can certainly include that.
Postage?
Yes.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, what life would that take in
The issue is whether the counties pay for it or will the voter continue to be obligated to pay for the postage.
Postage, who pays?
Could we also add signature verification on there?
Okay. Great. Other items?
Well, yes, could I recommend that maybe we could do a very early draft of the agenda well in advance of the meeting and circulate it, and then we could all comment via email and maybe add things as we think about it some more? Because I'm not sure I'm prepared to add things just now.
I'm happy to do that. Let me say early agenda. I'm happy to do that. The other thing that I'll be doing over the next couple of weeks is trying to get together people that, as we get to the bigger items, people that could speak to particular issues. Because, honestly, even given what I do, if you ask me to sit down and talk about the effect that this would have on special districts and municipalities, I would have no idea. So I think it would be incumbent upon Mickey and Kathy and others to tell me who are the proper people to come and talk about that, or if you feel comfortable talking about that, then we'll line you up. So
I feel comfortable.
Excellent.
Good.
Yes.
I feel comfortable as well, but I'd also like to have you invite Jeff Wilson from Colorado Municipal League.
I can absolutely do that. It's about time that I had lunch with Jeff again, so this will be my cause. Excellent. Other things related to this? Yes.
Well, I guess I would just caution that this appears to be a rather meaty agenda, and maybe we might want to think about dividing that up into a couple of different meetings, too. So I would hate to spend 15 minutes on each of these topics in order to move through a meeting.
That might be a very good idea, and I'm going to throw out another reason why that would be a good idea, which is that we do have a topic for next meeting, which I think would be a good thing to get out of the way. And so that might take us an hour or two and chop up the meeting a bit. So maybe we'll devise a list that would capture those things that make the most sense capturing together, and then we'll do another list and we'll do another portion of a meeting later. Does that make sense? As I line up the agenda, I'll sort of try to figure out a good stopping point and include what makes sense.
Okay.
Your thoughts on that are welcome, now or later. Any other? Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to add list maintenance to the list. List maintenance to the list.
Excellent.
Yeah. What was that?
List maintenance.
And I think that might be part of a larger question about, and I think it was gotten to earlier, but the question of registration and mobility of registration and registration modernization and all those pieces, I think, are a key part of all of this.
Okay.
While it may be a little bit off topic, Judd, it may be also appropriate to consider, as we're kind of expanding that in the context of voter registration, taking a look at the interplay between first-time registered to vote by mail and then voting by mail. I know that's often an issue with respect to a form of IDs or things like that they're submitted. It's a little bit broader of a topic.
Okay.
And perhaps not in connection with this legislation, but we should put on our thinking caps and agenda maybe for future discussion is addressing the current VRD model that we have in our state.
All right. All right. Other topics?
This is just a review of the last cost discussion. We'll get a copy of the spreadsheet that Russ Ragsdale put up and have the opportunity to add potential new costs after what we heard today. And we'll just submit that to you or CC everybody for discussion.
You can feel free to CC everybody if you like. But if you send things to me, I'll make sure that everybody gets them. If you want me to make sure that everybody gets them. Mm-hmm. The As it relates to Russ's particular spreadsheet, I can absolutely send that out, make sure everybody's got a copy of it. It's basically like an itemized version of the aggregate model that you see. So it might very well be helpful for all of you.
But the goal there is to come up with some criteria for data collection for both the primary and the general election?
Yeah, okay. So this brings up a new topic, which I was going to mention here in a couple moments. The secretary mentioned at some point earlier today, and I was sort of out of the room, but I kind of caught it, that he believes that there is some value in trying to collect information for either this coming primary or the general election to get a sense of costs. That makes a lot of sense to me. He made some suggestions about the ways we could do this. I think that's a great starting list. I think it's not exhaustive. There's probably some other ways that we could do that as well. We're working right now with the stats department at Colorado State University on a separate project for auditing state election outcomes or county and local election outcomes. It may very well be that they're a good place to go, too. They may have some great ideas. We also, and her name flew out of my head, Carol Hedges?
Yeah,
Is a good place to go, too. You may have some information on that.
You know, it's not her area. She's with the Colorado Fiscal Policy Institute. They haven't looked at elections. They're very unique, where they look at tax policy, really, and the effects of Tabor on all sorts of Colorado's infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But I'm waiting to hear back. I want to talk to Carol about who she could recommend to create a cost formula that'll help us.
Great. So there may be some different possibilities here, some different avenues. So I'll follow up on that and get back in touch with everyone.
I'm sorry, just kind of a point of clarification. And I apologize that I missed the last meeting, but it says in the action items is the creation of the four corners of the election modernization bill.
Right.
What are those?
Well, it's actually, now I have a list of 12. So is that, I
think all these different pieces is what we're talking about. Okay.
Maybe it's now a three-dimensional bridge game. This list, it kind of captures a lot of the different things that any bill that came through the legislature would necessarily have to deal with.
Is the mission of this commission to focus those pillars or 12 pieces through a prism of all-mail ballot elections, or is that one of those potential pillars?
It's certainly up for the members to decide whether or not they believe, based on their analysis of these factors, that whether all mail makes sense. I think, certainly there have been people on the committee already, commission, who have expressed a great, interest in one way or another. So I think we kind of already see a bit of a landscape in front of us. But there's a lot more conversation that has to go on. And I think the ultimate, where the secretary would like for this to go, what he's expressed to me, is that by December or January, when we're in a point of the legislative cycle where they would actually be talking about something like this, this group will have been able to voice whether it supports or doesn't support, and to what degree it supports or doesn't support, one of the various avenues that are available. And if it supports mail ballot, then what are its feelings about these individual items? And if it doesn't support it, then how can these individual items be addressed in other formats? So I think that's the goal on this particular, issue. We have obviously other major issues that will be subsumed in that time as well.
And do we think three meetings is enough time to do that?
Well, that's why we would need to staff it out to some degree.
Okay.
I think in this next meeting, if we could do the one other thing that I'm going to talk about here in a moment, and then get started with this, and then do the second half of the discussion of these topics in the, what would be October, no, September meeting, then that gets us a long way. And then at some point, our staff can kind of take over and say, okay, well, here's what we heard. we'll write it out, and then we can go over actual detail and come up with, you know, something to move forward with.
Okay.
And like I say, it's not a built-in that we're going to support something. You know, it may very well be that we can't find the votes. You know, there's three here, three there, and three there. It's possible.
I think another thing on our list should be county optional mail ballot.
Okay. All right. Other topics? I have a new one for you. If we have 8 minutes to tackle a new topic. Actually, this is sort of previewing a topic, which I think will take a little bit more time at the next one. So I'm about to hand you out a couple of pieces of paper. This is, these are copies of a couple of passages in our election statute, 140.116 and 140.117. And I've marked a couple of aspects of it that I wanted you to be aware of. Does everybody get a copy? So this is about verification of ballot issues. So in 140.116, we talk about the way we do a study of those who have signed a ballot, signed to get something on the ballot. And the way we do it now is that we do a random sample of that first section. It's a 5% random sample. If we come out of that 5% random sample with over 100% likelihood, 110% likelihood of meeting that the base number, which right now is 76,047, that based on the Secretary of State's vote totals in 2008, I guess, we got to 76,047. If you get to 110% of that number, based on the 5% random sample, it's no need to go on. You have been certified to the ballot. If you fall within 90 to 110%, then we have to do a line-by-line, 100% review of every signature, and we currently do that through another state agency, which reviews every line, does it under state law, and does a very good job of it. And we have to do that in 30 days. It's a very difficult process, and it takes a tremendous amount of resources to do. If you get under 90%, so the review, the 5% review, projects you to be under 90%, we at that point throw our hands up and say, that's not going to make the ballot unless you cure. If you flip to 140.117 and the portion that goes on 3B, which goes on one page and then continues on the next, talks about the cure. And the cure for an insufficiency means you could file an addendum, which would include additional signatures. And those additional signatures, if you flip to the last page, say that each signature shall be verified. So here we've set up sort of an odd model where you could submit 80,000 signatures, but only 60,000 are considered valid under a 5% random. That gets you under 90%. So then you submit another 80,000 signatures, which could be the exact same signatures that you submitted to the for the original 80,000, and because we didn't do a full analysis of the original sample, we do a line-by-line on the cure, we could catch a whole bunch of new signatures that, if we would have done a line-by-line on the original, we would know that they were already there. And instead, we get, you know, well over 110%, and we don't need to do a line-by-line, and we've got something certified to the ballot that, you know, maybe shouldn't have been certified to the ballot. So we've got a hole in our law. So what we were hoping this group might do is to, we'll you know, line this one up for you for the next meeting, and we'll spend a little time kind of crafting what we believe should be an alternative to our current model, and see what everybody thinks about that. Are there any thoughts on that? Yes, no? Darren, sounds like a terrible idea?
Sounds
good. Kevin likes it. So. Great. All right, so we will get that one all ready for next meeting. I failed to do something at the beginning that I should have done, which was to talk about minutes. We had the original minutes that we did, but then we had Joe submitted some revisions, suggested revisions to the minutes. Did anyone have any comments on both the original minutes and the revised minutes?
I thought the minutes were a little sparse.
Well, it didn't. They certainly didn't specify a lot of what individual people said. I think we're probably going to, you know, pump that up a little bit. But yeah, and I think Joe sort of did that to some extent. Were there other comments? Okay. So, is there? How about this? I'll make a motion that we accept Joe's revised minutes. In addition to the ones that we already had, and we'll bring those, we'll amalgamate those into one set of minutes, and all in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Excellent. Okay, thank you very much, and we will we'll get this stuff together. We'll be communicating over the next couple of weeks, and we'll prepare for the next meeting, which I believe is in July. So. And please communicate with me if you have any questions or comments or things you want to include or elsewhere. Thanks.
Thank you.